from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 30 years ago, a young Dick Cheney, chief of staff for President Gerald Ford, surveyed the wreckage of presidential authority left by Richard Nixon's disgrace and resignation and vowed to rebuild the power of the White House. He could hardly have known how direct a hand he would have tonight on Point, the most powerful vice president in American history, the world according to Dick Cheney. But first, we turn to Fallujah, Iraq, where coordinated insurgent attacks on American troops and a heavy U.S. response were the story of the day. The Marines, while still avoiding an all-out assault on Iraqi resistance, used air power to pound weapons caches and insurgent positions. Scott Peterson is a staff writer with the Christian Science Monitor, positioned just outside Fallujah. I asked him what he could tell us about the fighting in the city today.
There has been a lot of heavy fighting today in and around the edges of Fallujah. It seems that for the first time in many, many days, in fact several weeks, there have been coordinated attacks on several different multiple Marine locations. And in fact, today the response from the U.S. Marines was actually very disproportionate. Now that's using their word. They said that they dropped at least one 500-pound bomb on some of the insurgent positions, and I think that the purpose of that was really to send a message that this kind of attack would not be tolerated.
So coordinated insurgent attacks on numerous U.S. Marine positions and a very heavy American response.
That is correct. This is also coming just after, of course, this very, very strong attack last night that the United States made, that U.S. Marines made, on weapons caches that they found. Last night, reconnaissance teams found two vehicles that were packed full of explosives and ordnance. They called in Spectre gunships to shoot those. They fired upon them. They started off all the secondary explosions. This is what captivated us all on television last night because, of course, there was a live television camera on that. But instead of actually back-to-back fighting or face-to-face fighting there, what we saw were really the results of the taking down of this insurgent weapons dump.
Scott, President Bush said today in the White House that the fighting in Fallujah was now restricted to just pockets of resistance and that most of the city is, to quote him, returning to normal. Does that square with what you observe there?
Well, I don't think that that's entirely the case. And the reason is because, I mean, it may be argued that there are pockets in the sense that there's only a very small minority of people who really are hardcore insurgents in the city of Fallujah itself. I mean, remember, there are probably at least 200,000 people in that city now. There have been 60,000 or so which have left, but there's still 200,000 there, and the Marines are really only estimating that perhaps there are 2,000 of these relatively hardcore insurgents, and they also figure that they've knocked out about half of them in the last 2 weeks. That is a rough estimate that has been put forward by U.S. officers here, literally just in the last hour. They feel that those numbers aren't very large. So in that sense, you could argue that, indeed, with 2,000 people out of 200,000, that's 1% of the population. So there, by definition, it's a pocket. But frankly, they do control, as far as anyone can tell, all of the city inside the cordon. So I think in the classic sense of pockets of resistance, I think that's probably not true.
Scott, what is known at this point about the attitude of Fallujah's general citizenry, the civilians there, toward the insurgents, the resistance?
This is not clear. Of course, the Marines say that really they are unpopular. The insurgents are unpopular. Of course, the Marines are unpopular, but so are the insurgents in a lot of ways, in part because people don't want to see the results of what the insurgents are doing, and those results are U.S. Marine attacks on their city. So they are probably not fully in favor, but that said, they are also very prone to intimidation, and it's not clear when these insurgents work to get recruits and that kind of thing, you know, what kind of ultimatums they give to people, what kind of dynamics are at work. And, of course, we also must remember that in Fallujah there are several different armed groups that are kind of different centers of gravity, if you will, of power. There are jihadist elements who are there thinking that this is the way they're going to fight their holy war. There are former Ba'athist elements who are there. There are simply Iraqi nationalists who feel that this is just a way to get at their occupiers. So it really is a complex picture, and I think the Marines are day by day appreciating that to the point where they really are reluctant to consider any kind of an all-out assault yet.
Scott, much of the country here has been riveted by these live television images of the fighting as it unfolds. Where are reporters posted around Fallujah at this point?
Because the city is ringed, it means it's ringed by different Marine battalions, three in particular, and basically reporters, I mean, I, as we speak, am standing in the Marine headquarters which is just a couple of miles from that location where they are orchestrating all of this cordon and all of the military activity. Of course, there's certain things that I can get here in terms of overview, in terms of strategy, that perhaps some of my colleagues that are in the foxholes aren't getting. But what they're getting at the moment is, of course, a bird's eye view of what's actually going on the ground. And there are journalists embedded with various companies, and we slot in and out. I, for example, will be likely passing into one of these units in the next day or two.
But so far, we see the military brass, the U.S. brass, saying they still hope for some kind of negotiated outcome here. Of course, it was Saddam Hussein's birthday today. 1 year ago, U.S. forces fired on civilians, killing and wounding dozens in Fallujah. Is there hope of this ending with a welcome for American troops in this city?
That is really not a particularly likely outcome, but it is just about the only outcome that is going to enable the Marines here and the U.S. military in general to leave Fallujah in a pacified state and hand it over to a sovereign Iraqi government. That is what they say is their end state. They recognize that they are now operating from the negative side of the ledger, if you will, and part of that is because they feel that because of the events of the 31st of March when the four American contractors were killed, that speeded up the Marine deployment here. It speeded up the need for them to actually do something militarily. Orders came from on high for them to move forward. They had a plan all worked out and in place, they say, to basically give Fallujah back to the Iraqis, if you will, and to kind of reestablish some of the institutions and things like that to run so that Iraqis could run their own affairs here. But all of that was pushed forward, and a military response was ordered, basically, for the killing of those four contractors. But, of course, now in retrospect, it looks like that may have seriously hampered the U.S. Marines' ability here to find a long-term solution.
Four American contractors killed, and now 600-plus Iraqis killed, and, of course, the whole Middle East watching very closely, just as Americans are watching.
That's exactly right. I mean, the stakes could not be higher, and the real question, I think, and what historians are going to look at is whether or not Fallujah in the coming few months becomes the clarion call for Iraqi nationalists who will always say, remember Fallujah as the place where they defeated the American occupiers, or will this be the place where, when history turns, that the Marines look back and say, remember Fallujah for the time that we got it right on a complex peacekeeping mission that basically ended an occupation with a peaceful city.
Scott, thanks very much for joining us. Be safe there.
Thank you.
Scott Peterson is a staff writer with the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with me earlier today from the outskirts of Fallujah. At the end of this hour, we'll hear more about the Fallujah standoff and its implications for the American effort in Iraq and the broader Middle East. Few images will paint a more telling picture of Dick Cheney's unprecedented influence than the moment around 9:30 tomorrow morning when the vice president sits down beside President Bush to testify shoulder to shoulder, as they insisted, before the 9/11 commission. From the outside, it's hard to tell where the vice presidency ends and the Bush presidency begins. Dick Cheney appears to have been an irresistible force on major issues, from U.S. energy policy to foreign affairs, war, and the collection and reading of national intelligence. Now he's being aimed like a howitzer at the Kerry campaign. This hour, On Point, we're talking about the worldview, the impact, and the unfinished business of arguably the most powerful vice president in American history. How do you read the Dick Cheney view of the world? Brave, bold, dark, paranoid? Does the tough guy, VP, bring you comfort? Does he bring you fear? What's your sense of the Cheney impact on the Bush years, of the Cheney hand on the tiller? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Frank Foer, associate editor of The New Republic. He co-wrote a piece for the magazine entitled The Radical, What Dick Cheney Really Believes. Good evening and welcome, Frank Foer.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for being with us. And with us from Bethesda, Maryland, Ken Walsh, chief White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. He's covered the evolution of Dick Cheney's career from his days as Wyoming's congressman through the first and second Bush administrations. He traveled with the vice president on his most recent trip to Asia. Good evening and welcome, Ken Walsh. Good to have you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And with me in the studio tonight, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack. Great to have you right here.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guests.
Let's just get a little bit of the vice president's voice before we dive in to thinking about this vice president. Here's Dick Cheney, April 26, 2004, at Westminster College in New Wilmington, Pennsylvania, pulling no punches in his criticism of Democratic Senator John Kerry.
In his years in Washington, Senator Kerry has been one vote out of 100 in the United States Senate. And fortunately, on matters of national security, he was usually in the minority. But the presidency is an entirely different proposition. The president always cast the deciding vote.
There's the voice, there's the man, the vice president right next to that president casting the deciding vote. Frank Foer, your headline was What Dick Cheney Really Believes. Please tell us.
Well, that piece was about his foreign policy. And I think for a lot of people, Dick Cheney and Dick Cheney's hawkishness in this administration was something of a mystery, because he came into this administration identified with the first Bush administration, mm-hmm. identified with Colin Powell and Brent Scowcroft and a view of the world that was much more multilateral, that emphasized stability over such mushy concerns as democracy. And but I think that, that image of Dick Cheney, that identification with Powell and Scowcroft, really misunderstands where Cheney was coming from. In all the debates, the foreign policy debates in the first Bush administration, Cheney was always to the right of Powell and Scowcroft. And on the great issues of that day, on talking about the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the shaping of the post-Cold War order, and even on the construction of the Gulf War strategy, Cheney was always significantly to the right. He was always much more willing to deploy American force, to take grand, risky steps to shake things up. And he was even talking about the importance of democratization to American security. So, it's really difficult to put Cheney and Cheney's foreign policy worldview into an ideological box. But I think that there are a lot of similarities between his worldview and what's come to be known as the neoconservative worldview.
Very tough and willing, more than willing, to aggressively promote democracy, as you write, through military power. Ken Walsh, you write, on the other hand, your headline is, really, he's not as gruff as everyone says. Can you spell S-P-I-N spin? Is the tough guy, Dick Cheney, just a creation of media spin?
Well, I think there's two points here. One is that the public, Dick Cheney has been sort of stereotyped into this caricature of a not only an ideologue and a conservative, and I agree with a lot of Frank said about his views, but also on a personal level, a guy who sort of you wouldn't want to sit next to in a movie theater or a bar, because he's just he's uninteresting and has little he's just sort of this gruff zealot.
You've known him for a long time. You just flown to Asia and back with him. You're saying there's another Dick Cheney, the softer, gentler, sweeter Dick?
Well, what you have here is, I think on this Asia trip, and I've known Cheney for a long time in different incarnations, on the Asia trip, we got a lot of time with him and off the record and some on the record, but mm-hmm. basically, sitting across from him, you can see why Bush values him so highly. This is a guy who, no matter what you think of where he comes out on issues, he is thoughtful, he is reassuring, he has an answer to everything. Now, that may be unsettling to a lot of people, but basically, that's what Bush likes. I mean, Cheney understands a lot of issues a lot more with a lot more depth and has studied them a lot more carefully than Bush. For instance, on the trip, He, as on most of his trips, he brings this green carry-on bag containing about a dozen books that he reads. And he is a real reader, and he likes biography and history and so on. Now, the president, of course, isn't much of a reader.
Not even the newspaper, he tells us.
Not even the newspaper. Cheney does follow such things. And during the trip and in other reporting, I think you can't underestimate the difference it makes that Cheney is not running for president himself.
Ken Walsh, we're going to have to take a short break and come back. We want to hear more about that. Jack Beatty, I see you chomping at the bit. We want to hear what you've got to say as well. We're talking tonight about the most powerful vice president in American history, Dick Cheney. Do you see Dick Cheney as George Bush's right-hand man or the shadow president? Where does the buck stop in the Bush White House? On whose desk? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the impact, the influence, the unfinished business of Vice President Dick Cheney, arguably the most powerful vice president in American history. I'm joined tonight from Bethesda, Maryland by Ken Walsh, Chief White House Correspondent for U.S. News and World Report, author of Air Force One, The History of Presidents and Their Planes. From Washington, Frank Foer, Associate Editor at The New Republic and author of the forthcoming book, How Soccer Explains the World. Frank, you're a man of many interests. Our own Jack Beattie is with us here in the studio. Let's listen just a little bit to Vice President Dick Cheney. This March 17th, this year, in Simi Valley, California, at the Ronald Reagan Library there, on the one-year anniversary of the White House ultimatum to Saddam Hussein to leave Iraq with his sons.
Standing here in 2004, we can see clearly how a new enemy was organizing and gathering strength over a period of years. And the struggle we are in today against terrorist enemies intending violence on a massive scale requires the same qualities of leadership that saw our nation to victory in the Cold War. We must build and maintain military strength capable of operating in different theaters of action with decisive force. We must not only have that power, but be willing to use it when required to defend our freedom and our security.
Dick Cheney, just a month and a half ago, you can join the conversation tonight. What's your sense of the Cheney impact on the Bush years on the United States? Does the tough guy image, Vice President, bring you comfort or bring you fear? And what about Dick Cheney's view that the American president needs to be large and in charge? Are you on board with that? How do you read the Dick Cheney view of the world? Brave, bold, dark, paranoid. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beattie, we've heard from Ken Walsh, who has been on the plane next to Dick Cheney with his green bag full of books and his gentle demeanor. On the other hand, if you judge by actions, there's been a lot of hard action during this administration.
There has indeed. Mary McCarthy famously said and got sued for libel for saying of Lillian Hellman that she didn't believe anything Lillian Hellman said, including the buts and the ands. I feel that way about Dick Cheney. I have rarely seen a public official who speaks in such blatantly propagandistic and immediately terms that are so wildly discrepant from reality. Again and again on Meet the Press appearances, in Obiter Dictor with the press, in speeches, he has made claims about Iraq, about the WMD, about the nuclear capability, about the labs, about, you go on, about the connection with Al-Qaeda, which his CIA, which his State Department, which his own president has said are not so, and yet he keeps saying them as if he has no regard for testing his thoughts against what we would think of as reality. Now, that's propaganda. So when this man opens his mouth, what he's trying to say is be afraid, be very afraid, and give us all the power we need because we're the ones who are protecting you. And I think he's done great violence to public speech.
And with those comments, Jack, with that attitude, that message as you see it, driving, herding the country toward what?
Toward trust us. Toward support us.
To what end?
So that we can fight this war against this implacable enemy in the way it needs to be fought. And what is his idea? What are his ideas there? He believes in force. I mean, he has talked about how, you know, the fear is the leitmotif of his view of foreign policy. How are we going to get our way in the Arab world? Well, Bernard Lewis, the Arab, has told him the Arabs fear force. Use force, make them bleed, and they'll believe you. Of course, that's really worked against Al-Qaeda, which has been on a rampage these past 2 years, ever since we've been bleeding them. So this man has these blunt and crude and, I think, really dangerous views, Hobbesian views about the world that have got this country into terrible trouble.
Frank Foer, Dick Cheney as Hobbesian, Dick Cheney as propagandist. What do you say?
I definitely agree that he does have this dark Hobbesian view of the world. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he admitted it himself. And in the Woodward book, I think he describes him as being the guy that Bush put in charge of all his worst case scenarios. And the point I would disagree with Jack on is that I don't think that necessarily what he's saying is intended to be propaganda as much as it is the what flows naturally from his kind of very fearful Hobbesian worldview. I'm not sure you know, I think it's an open question as to whether he was intentionally misleading the country or as to whether he was actually sold on a set of facts that that didn't end up panning out.
But Frank, Jack is saying, if I read it right, correct me if I'm wrong, Jack, but that even since there have been corrections to some pretty major inaccuracies, the vice president hasn't backed off. He continues to use them. I guess that's where the propaganda charge comes in.
Right. And you know, we'll see. I mean, maybe my sense is that he truly believes everything he says, which, you know, in one analysis might make him even scarier and more dangerous than somebody who is willfully misleading.
What's the origin or the root system for this dark view of the world that you describe, Frank Foer?
That's an excellent question. I mean, I think it's in part something that is just temperamental. He's always been described as being kind of taciturn, being dark and gloomy about things, and I think that has a lot to do with it. And then secondly, there's a series of specific experiences I think during his time at the Pentagon that inform his Hobbesian worldview, which is that he feels like he watched the Soviet Union collapse and the CIA didn't have a good sense of precisely how far advanced the Soviet biological and chemical weapons program was. We went in and we invaded Iraq. We didn't know how far along the Iraqi nuclear program was. So in his view, based on his experiences, he feels like he's got to assume the absolute worst case scenario.
And he lost faith very deeply in the CIA. Ken Walsh, for many Bush supporters, Dick Cheney's presence has always been quite comforting. Those who weren't fully in confidence in George Bush saw him as adult supervision, but you know, many others just saw him as a strong and continue to as a strong, steady hand in the White House. My Jack Beatty sees him as a propagandist and a dangerous Hobbesian. How does he see himself?
Well, I think the one way to look at this is that Cheney, of course, came to sort of power and fame under Gerald Ford and became Gerald Ford's chief of staff. He also, of course, was a congressman from Wyoming, which is in one of the most conservative districts in the country. And in those, you know, there's one congressman in Wyoming, one member of Congress, and that was Dick Cheney for a number of years. And you know, to understand where he came from, you know, this is oil country, ranchers. His conservative instincts were constantly reinforced, not only by re-election, by the nature of the Wyoming electorate. I mean, it's a very conservative place, and that's where he comes from. I mean, he sees the world much the way he did then, in terms of the way sort of a Western landman sees things. Then he defense secretary, but I think something changed him also when he was at Halliburton. When I knew him when he was in Congress, he was very open and accessible, much different than he is today. He was not suspicious, for instance, of the media. You could always get him on the phone.
Now, this is interesting. What happened?
Well, that's the big question. At Defense, the people who covered him in the Pentagon felt that, you know, he wasn't hiding out. So it seems like something changed him, and I think it must have been the Halliburton experience. He's off this energy company. He's dealing with money, with special interests, and I'm not quite sure what it was. But the guy that I saw on this trip was not the guy I knew who was a member of Congress.
Now that is fascinating. He went off into the world not of politics but of business,
yes,
of big time capitalism, and came back gloomier, less open, more suspicious. You're saying?
Well, I think that did happen. Now, I think what Frank was saying about the worst-case scenario, this is very true, and I think that Bush actually values this in Cheney. Cheney will look at the worst thing that can happen and will always be arguing for protecting against it. Bush finds that a comforting voice to have
you know,
at his elbow.
You know, Jack, when you pull back the covers on the oil business, and I've worked in it just a little bit, there's a lot of fear and loathing in there. It's power politics lies very squarely at the base of oil business that the Halliburton's so connected to.
Oh, sure. And it's led him into some strange passes. You know, Halliburton did $35 million worth of business with Saddam Hussein after 1991. Now, it was arranged through via circuitous routes. He was a big advocate of ending sanctions on Libya, on Iraq, on other countries, because it was bad for the oil business. And the French government is now investigating a bribe of, I think, some $100 million that Halliburton is alleged to have given to Nigeria, to officials in Nigeria, on an oil deal there. Now, we don't know what's going to come of that, but he was the CEO when these, I think it was $18 million, when this $18 million was parceled out on the allegation to in bribes. So, it's a rough business, and he probably played a pretty rough part in it.
You don't get the oil by having soft, rounded elbows, and no doubt he didn't. Let's take some calls here. Dave is calling from Boston. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. Great show.
Good to have you, Dave.
So I had just a quick comment in that I think many Americans have often believed that there's something of a shadow government or at least influence out there. And in Dick Cheney's case, I think he's very, very visible. So if there were influences, at least at this point in time, I think those influences are visible. And the other point is, and I'll take any comments up the air, is that, you know, it's nice to have that duality in the office. You've got Dick Cheney, who is apparently a rather deep thinker. And you've got George Bush, who's certainly the public persona of this presidency.
And you like that twinning. It brings you comfort.
I think it does. If you want to compare that with, the Howard Dean presidency, he was a common guy, if you will. And this is stretching my point a little bit.
Howard
but
Dean?
I think Cheney and Mr. Bush are part of the elites. And a lot of people like to see that expertise and background and eliteness, if you will, actually causing profit.
We're losing you there, Dave, but let us pick that up. Ken Walsh, let me go first to you here on this, on the relationship between the vice president and the president. And in particular, let's start with, if you would, this issue of visibility and invisibility. For a long, long time after 9/11, Dick Cheney was as deep in the bunker as any top-tier American official I can ever recall. What was he doing during all that time, and what is his channel of influence to the president?
Well, first of all, about that in being in the bunker idea, I think from what I gather, initially there was just a real concern for safety and having the president and the vice president separated. So whether it was overdone or not, that the feeling was that they should not be together and Cheney should be hiding out for succession of government purposes.
I mean, there seemed to be months where he was in the undisclosed location,
right,
and had a bunker feeling to the way it was presented, whether or not it was literally a bunker.
Well, I think that it turns out that I believe that the bunker was very close to various golf courses around the country, too. I mean, for instance, Jackson Hole. Right.
The 19th hole.
that's right. So it wasn't exactly that he was, he was in a fallout shelter the whole time.
But, okay. Well, that's a different picture.
Well, it is. And I think the other part is on sort of what, but I think the idea there was both security related and very political. The desire was let Bush be out front. We don't want anybody to seem to be overshadowing him. Cheney can tend to do that. I think that you're seeing more of Cheney now, but in a limited, this sort of attack dog role, which you referred to at the top here. But basically, I think there has been a concern, for that matter, what became of Karl Rove? We never hear of him anymore either.
Well, how does Vice President Cheney interact with President Bush?
Well, he's on the phone with Bush a lot. On this Asia trip, for instance, he was talking to Bush not only about the stops he was making, the things he was doing, he was coordinating about the insurrections in Iraq and what should be done on these video conferencing systems that they have on his Air Force 2 and on various locations, or ambassador's residences and so on. So his influence derives, I think, virtually completely from his influence on Bush. What I started to say earlier about him not wanting to run for president, it makes a huge difference because that's partly why he's not that interested in publicity about himself. On this trip, for instance, he could have had wonderful stories day in and day out. He was just off the record virtually all the time. He just wasn't interested in that. And so this is partly why Bush trusts him, because he doesn't feel that Cheney is going to try to supersede him, that Cheney is there to serve whatever agenda they cook up.
But how do you read that relationship between these two men? Is it father-son? Is it the confidant in the shadows? Does Cheney drive Bush?
I think he drives Bush in some ways, but I think that he's very deferential to Bush. Cheney looks a lot older than Bush. This is often remarked. He's not that much older than Bush. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a certain sort of older brother, younger brother relationship. But I think it's more Bush finds in Cheney the things that Bush does not bring to the table, a thoughtfulness, a depth of experience in Washington, and an answer for everything. I mean, if you talk to Cheney at any length, he seems to have an answer for everything, and this can be very reassuring for a guy like Bush, who likes the idea that he can come up with a simple answer and that Cheney is sort of going to backstop him and fill in the blanks.
It seems to be almost a universal characteristic of his inner circle, that answer for everything point of view. Frank Ford, how do you see the Bush fingerprints, the Cheney fingerprints in the actual strategy and policies of this administration? How much is Dick Cheney? How much is George Bush?
Of course, there's a lot of this that we don't know. You can, you know, for 20 Bob Woodward books, I don't think that we'll have an answer to that question. And in part, that has to do with the Cheney MO. I think that this image of the secret Dick Cheney is something that he cultivates himself. When you talk to people within the White House, people who are out of the White House, they'll tell you that a lot of times at the last minute, Cheney would intervene in various policy debates and change policy very significantly at the last minute. And this is after Cheney sits through meetings without saying anything. He's kind of trained his staff to sit through meetings where they don't say anything except for maybe a few kind of telling words at the end of the meeting.
Run but, silent, run
even,
deep.
Even, kind of. even within the White House, I think that the Cheney people and Cheney himself are very secretive about how they exert their influence.
Secretive to the point that, the president knows what they're thinking.
Presumably.
Jack.
Well, you know, tomorrow's hearing with these two men is an extraordinary spectacle. It's unimaginable, to put it mildly, that Lyndon Johnson would ever bring his vice president.
Come as a Siamese twin.
Now, I'm not saying this. William Schneider, who's an objective analyst on CNN, said on CNN, to my amazement, in a burst of candor, because they have constraints, he said, this meeting tomorrow admits of two interpretations, neither one favorable to Bush. One, they don't want to be caught contradicting each other. Mm-hmm. And two, Bush doesn't think he can explain himself.
Doesn't look good, but Dick Cheney will be at his side. We're going to come back and look at the 9/11 testimony that's upcoming tomorrow. President and Vice President, shoulder to shoulder, as usual. We're talking tonight about the most powerful Vice President in American history. My guests, Ken Walsh, Frank Foer, our own Jack Beatty is here. You can join the conversation as well. What do you hear the Vice President whispering in the President's ear? Why have the VP and Prez insisted on testifying shoulder to shoulder before the 9/11 Commission tomorrow? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the most powerful vice president in American history, perhaps the imperial vice presidency of Dick Cheney. My guest tonight, Frank Foer, associate editor of the New Republic, author of the forthcoming How Soccer Explains the World. Ken Walsh, chief White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. Jack Beatty is with us as well. And you can join us. Why do we have such a powerful vice president right now? Could George W. Bush have picked a vice president more different than his dad's? Quail. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go way back in history for a moment to June 27th, 1975. And here's some tape from an interview with Dick Cheney then. He was deputy chief of staff in the Ford White House. Donald Rumsfeld was there as a colleague, I think, as chief of staff at that time. Cheney himself later became chief of staff. And here he's asked by an interviewer if he and Rumsfeld get involved in substantive policy matters as well as White House procedure.
Do you and Mr. Rumsfeld get involved in substantive policy matters in addition to procedural matters?
No, you know, we try, I think fairly faithfully, to avoid becoming advocates for an individual on a staff or for a particular position on this in terms of an issue. It's important that the rest of the troops feel that we will honestly present their position to the president, that the process itself won't warp their recommendation. If you're perceived as a hard-nosed advocate for a particular position, pretty soon you aren't an objective transmitter of information to the president. They won't trust you. Mm-hmm. The system will break down. So you try to avoid that kind of thing. But, yeah, I will from time to time see something I think doesn't make sense or something we should do, and I'll talk to the individual who's got responsibilities in that area and suggest that he take a look at it. Procedure, too, has a huge impact on substance. I mean, the mere fact that one of your assignments is to see to it that before a paper goes forward to the president for a decision, that it has been fully staffed, can, you know, in effect, result in throwing another viewpoint into the decision paper so that when it goes forward to the president ends up making a different decision than he would if that viewpoint wasn't in there. But the key there is not to get comments based upon what your views are of what policy should be, but rather to see to it that the president has the information he needs to make an intelligent decision. So he doesn't blind side. You've got to be careful about what your motives are when you do that kind of thing.
A younger, gentler Dick Cheney, maybe, in 1975, their deputy chief of staff in the Ford White House. No hard-nosed advocate, but clearly a hard-nosed advocate today. You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Janice is calling from Hull, Massachusetts. Hi, Janice. You're on the air.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am fascinated by all of this, and I found an interesting study about the conservative mind, as it were, and it was done by UC Berkeley, so a somewhat right-thinking friend of mine wouldn't read it. But it appears that after a huge meta-study of over 22,000, a big, big study, that...
And it's easy. There are many conservatives to study.
Yes, and over 50 years of material and paper and so
okay.
forth. And then a huge... certain psychological factors linked to political conservatism include fear and aggression, dogmatism and intolerance of ambiguity, uncertainty avoidance, a need for cognitive closure, which is sort of a repetition, and terror management, which is linked to the endorsement of inequality. And I notice that people, as they get older, get more so of whatever they were to begin with.
So is that the profile of the leader or deputy leader that you want in the midst of a war on terror, Janice?
Absolutely not, because I'm an ordinary individual, a regular American citizen, and I read a lot. So I know about things like UMMA, U-M-M-A, which is the tribal loyalty oath that Muslims take. Or feel, and it's no surprise to me whatsoever that the Shiites and the Sunni would unite against American troops.
But there's a psychological profile, perhaps, that fits Dick Cheney, perhaps not Frank Ford. Does that sound like the vice president you know?
I think, there are elements of that sound like him. I mean, I think it's kind of, Cheney is not... an unintellectual man, as Ken has pointed out. He's somebody who reads. He's quite wonkish.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a he's got a sense of history. CIA analysts I know who briefed him in the past have described him as an extremely inquisitive guy who works based on the Socratic method.
Mm-hmm.
And digs deep into the things that he is reading and comes out and asks intelligent questions. I mean, I don't think that there's any question as to his intelligence. I think it's more a question of as we've pointed out before, his worldview, that it is extremely Hobbesian, and for all the intellectual agility that he can sometimes show, he clings very tightly to, I think his worldview. I think it is pretty fair to characterize him as an ideologue. I've heard him quoted as describing himself as being extremely conservative. When I asked his staff when I was working on that piece last November for the New Republic to describe to me how they would classify Cheney, and they would tell me that they would ask Cheney, how does he classify himself? And he says, I'm a red meat stalwart conservative.
And no two ways about it. Let's get one more call. John's on the line from Buffalo, New York. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thank you for taking the call.
Yeah.
I would like to comment that it should really be President Cheney. Quite frankly, Bush is the brand name stooge. I think that he is, in fact, the power in the White House. He's implementing policies developed by the second tier, if you will, of fellows like Wolfowitz, Pearl, Feith, Crystal, et al. And I think what you're seeing at the 9/11 Commission is Cheney playing Edgar Bergen to Bush's Charlie McCarthy.
Yeah, we've got our time is short, but John, thank you for your call. Ken Walsh, our caller rattles off the, you know, Pearl, Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, and so on. Frank Foer writes that this really is Dick Cheney's gang, Dick Cheney's group. Is he the master and commander of the neocons?
Well, I think he's certainly at the center of that. You know, we also have, remember, he was with Rumsfeld in the Ford White House. These people go back a very long way together. Louis Libby, is known as Scooter Libby, is another one of these people, very conservative guys, very secretive. And this you know, you talk about this idea of either a shadow government or sort of a cell in the government. This is what this amounts to. Now, it doesn't extend across the board. I mean, these guys don't get into a lot of social issues. They're very national security and foreign policy and energy policy focused. But, you know, other issues they really don't get into.
And I've got to ask you very quickly about the vice president's health. It's been an issue, his heart at a number of points. How is it today? Is there any doubt he'll go forward as a candidate?
Well, I mean, I have my view of that is if Bush hits 40% or lower, all bets are off about Cheney staying on the ticket.
Really?
Simply because of the political situation. Cheney did not help Bush very much the last time in picking up a big state, for instance. Now, he's very popular with the conservative base, but if Bush drops down very seriously starts to tank, I think come August, all bets will be off. That's
well,
my personal view.
There is a fascinating thought to go out on. Ken Walsh, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been just great having you. Thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you.
Ken Walsh, Chief White House Correspondent for U.S. News and World Report, and Frank Foer at The New Republic, thank you very much for being with us. Great stuff.
Thanks a lot.
Jack Beatty, final thought.
Well, you know, there's a joke about the question John raised, and the joke went, it was heard in the last campaign, George Bush is only one heart attack removed from being president.
Okay. We'll go out with that one. We can see where you stand on this one, Jack, and I must say it's just as clear and straightforward as the vice president might like. It's no shades of gray here. Jack, thanks a lot for being with us tonight. Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a look at the ramifications of the bloody standoff in Fallujah. This is On Point. Fighting in Fallujah appears to be steadily intensifying as insurgents continue their attacks on U.S. positions and U.S. troops retaliate in increasing force. But American commanders say they are trying hard not to let the situation explode into all-out battle for fear of the broader consequences, not just the consequences in Fallujah. If full-scale combat does erupt, the most dangerous man on the battlefield might not be an insurgent armed to the teeth with explosives, but an Al Jazeera cameraman ready to broadcast Iraqi civilian bloodshed to the entire country, to the entire Middle East. Joining me now to discuss the potential ramifications of the fighting in Fallujah is Michael Vickers, Director of Strategic Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments and a former Special Forces officer himself. Good evening and welcome, Michael Vickers.
Good evening.
Thanks a lot for being with us. We just couldn't take our eyes off the live feeds from Fallujah today, the heavy U.S. bombardment there, and the persistent insurgent resistance. But step back for a moment with us, Michael Vickers, and look at the broader picture. What are U.S. commanders wrestling with here when they wrestle not only with the situation on the ground, which looks tough enough, but the broader implications of what's going on in Fallujah?
Well, as you correctly note, there's a tactical problem of how to reduce this insurgent pocket in Fallujah, but there's a broader strategic problem as to what the battle actually means and how it's perceived more widely in Iraq, but also in the broader Arab world.
What's at stake here?
Well, Fallujah's taken on a symbol, what is really an isolatable city. I mean, the Shiite south is really far more important strategically than Fallujah is, has taken on a national symbol to some extent in Iraq. And it's playing very badly in the Arab world. So even where the U.S. is trying to only fire when fired upon and trying to use precise firepower against insurgent positions, the images still look at one as the U.S. Hammering the city. And
So what is the symbolism that's emerged from that's growing around Fallujah?
Well, that basically, rather than dealing with hardcore insurgents, about 1,500 or so, it's estimated, in a city of a couple hundred thousand, that really it's the U.S. laying siege to the city. And of course, we may win the battle tactically, but suffer a defeat in the sense of the wider war in terms of popular opinion.
Is there a way for U.S. forces to thread the needle here and escape that symbolism, or is the die cast here? Is the United States just going to have to live with some bloody, maybe even oppressive symbolism out of Fallujah?
Well, to some extent, I think we have to live with it. To the extent that there's been some indications that the local people in Fallujah have been helping, and
helping
US,
who?
Helping U.S. Marines, actually, mm-hmm. identify insurgent pockets, mm-hmm. and to the extent that shapes perceptions, that the people are really on our side rather than not, will help matters. But there's likely still to be some negative consequences, no matter what. And the broader problem now is the perception of U.S. objectives. You know, are we trying to impose our will on the Iraqi people rather than liberate them?
And what about the implications for security in the rest of the country? How do or do they hinge on the outcome in Fallujah?
They may. I mean, the general belief is that what's going on in Najaf is actually more important, since the Shiites are the majority, and that's really the heartland. If you lose the Shiite heartland, you've really lost Iraq at that point. But Fallujah's taken on a symbolism for Iraqis beyond the Sunnis, actually, that would otherwise transcend its importance.
And beyond Iraq, is this a significant confrontation for the larger American image in the Middle East?
Oh, definitely. I mean, as senior U.S. government officials, Secretary Rumsfeld and Secretary Powell and others have complained, we're getting our brains beat in by Al Jazeera. It's not necessarily fair. It's pretty biased reporting, but that's the reality in which we have to operate.
How does this leave the notion of a handover, however limited that might be, on June 30th, Michael Vickers?
Well, there's not a lot of legitimacy. I think that's one of the problems, is that the UN really isn't adding anything. And, you know, again, the problem is just the large-scale U.S. footprint here and the perception that it's really a U.S. occupation now and not a U.S. liberation or nation-building effort.
And the difficulty of removing that footprint when there's such an active confrontation on. Michael Vickers, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Sure, my pleasure.
Michael Vickers, former Special Forces officer, former CIA operations officer, and director of strategic studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.